No, I would like to get started. It looks like not everybody's kind of arrived yet. The first thing I wanted to do was talk about the results from the learning experiment from class last time. But to do that, to really do this right, I would like to have a couple of people here who weren't here at the end last time. So we're not quite going to do that. And I can't do any of the clicker questions before then because it'll erase the work that I did. Is that true? Maybe that's not true. Maybe I don't need that work. So maybe I'll pop that up and just get started with it.
About the final?
Yes.
Is it going to be open notes too?
Yes. And what I'd like to do by reading day, is that likely to happen? Yeah, so the last class, which will be on Wednesday of next week from today, I'll try to give a summary of all the stuff that we covered, and if I can get it all together, I will also give you a sample final. And just like I did with the midterm, the sample final will consist of the questions that will be on the final, but with slight variations so that you don't just like copy them. And that'll give you a sense of exactly what kind of problems to study so that you can make sure you master them.
And ours is on Wednesday, right? 12 to 3.
Pardon me?
12 to 3 on Wednesday.
The exam, yeah, so there's today, this Wednesday, next Wednesday is the last class, and the Wednesday after that is the final. And then, right here. Different time. All right, so. So night. All right, so this is what happened last time. We asked a series of questions, which I may not even remember all of. Oh, whoops, okay. There we go. All right, so I think these are the... I think these were the questions, you can see them. So I asked everybody to click in on 5 questions. The first one was age, and the categories were, are you 18, 19, 20, 21, or 22 and over? Let's ignore sex for a second. The next one was height. Are you in the beginning of 5 feet, the second quartile, the third quartile, the fourth quartile, or 6 feet and above? Do you know your own blood type, yes or no? And do you use a hairdryer, yes or no? And then I also recorded, not carefully in order, but whether someone was a male or female, boys and girls. And the goal was to create a learning system that would, or at least a classifier, that would be able to take answers to these different questions, except for question one here, and use it to predict the answer to question one. Okay? So we want to try to figure out if we know somebody's age and their height and their whether or not they know their blood type and whether or not they use a hairdryer, can we guess whether that person's a boy or a girl? At least among the population of people that hang out in this class. It turns out that it doesn't work well for like my family. I tried to use the data that we learned collected from this class to try to classify people in my family, and it turned out that it classifies my son as a girl. But we'll see why that is in just a moment. He's drawn from a slightly different population. So this is what I did. So I collected the data. We had, I think, 17 people were in class by the end there. There were 4 people who were present in class, but somehow weren't present anymore by the time we did this demo. Not sure exactly how that happened. It surprised me. One of these people is here now, which is good. All right, but we had 17 people altogether that we were able to collect data on. And these are the clicker numbers of the people, just so that I have a concrete... a concrete way of labeling everybody. And so what can we ask about these people? We know their answers to all the questions. What we'd like to know is which are the right questions to ask if you want to try to figure out whether someone's a boy or a girl. So what I did is I wrote a little program that does this. Let's see. Here we go. All right, so one by one, it takes the 17 people and asks, okay, here's one of the questions I can ask is, do you know, let's see, are you 17? Yes, versus no. So we can split everybody into two classes based on whether they're, they answer that they are 17 or 18 or they're not. I guess the first one that was asked is, for question zero, did you answer A?
Now, I already forgot what question zero was, so let me see if I can get it on the screen at the same time. Okay, so question zero. So are you 18 or not? That's the first thing we could split on. And here's what would happen with the 17 people in class if you split on that data. It says that, so I did things in two ways. I said, of the people who answered A to this, what do we get? And of the people who answered question zero saying not A, that exclamation mark equals means not equal to A. So of the ones who answered A, exactly one of them is a girl, and none of them were boys. So in some sense, that's a very good question to ask, right? Because if the answer is yes, you're 18, then at least in this data, you're a girl. I guess we have one 18-year-old in class and happens to be a girl. On the other hand, if you answer no to that question, then what this is saying is 10 of those people were boys, they clicked A for sex, and six of the people were girls, and so it's a 62%, 37% split, which isn't very clean, right? I mean, if we now had to guess whether you're a boy or a girl based on just that one question, and the answer was no, it wouldn't really tell you as much as you'd like. So that's one concrete example. But we could, the program then actually enumerates all possible questions that could be asked and their answers. So the next one is, okay, question zero, did a person click C? What was C? C is 20. So the 20-year-olds, of the 20-year-olds in the class, two of them are girls and six of them are boys. Of the ones who aren't 20-year-olds, eight of them are girls and one of them's a boy. That's actually a pretty good split right there. Not great, but you know, mostly we get girls of this age and boys of this age. So that would be a not unreasonable thing to ask, but there are better ones to ask. So let me find one of the much better ones. Here's a very good one, but sort of an unfair one. Question one, if you answered A, question one was, are you a boy or a girl? If you answered A, that means you're a boy, is that right? Yeah, so of the people who did that, all 10 of them were boys. Of the people who answered no to that, all 10 of them were girls. So this is a very good question for determining whether or not somebody's a boy or a girl. Can you see why that's sort of not fair though, right? I mean, basically we're taking the answer as the question. So this really doesn't tell us anything. Right? If we're trying to classify people as to whether they're a boy or a girl based on whether they say they're a boy or a girl, it's kind of circular. So we can't use that question. That was just meant as a simple example, but I didn't get much of a reaction from people. All right. So here's one that's kind of interesting. So this says question two, clicking A. So what was question two? Height. Okay. So if you click A for height, so that's between 5 and 5'3". If you click A for height, then you're a girl, at least according to this data. All six people who clicked on yes, they were all girls. And of the people who said no, 10 of them were boys and one was a girl. This is an excellent question to ask, right? In fact, of all the questions that were in the data set, this was basically the best one. Okay, because what makes a question a good question to ask in terms of being able to, expecting that you're gonna get good answers and expecting that the answers will generalize to more people? For one thing, you don't want to ask a question where there's a very small number of people who answer it one way or the other way, because then probably it's noise, right? Probably you're not getting anything reliable. It's just a quirk. Like, if you're under, let's see, what was one that had a very small number of answers? So this is one. So question two, ask if you're between 5'3 and 5'6". Only one person answered yes to that question. That person happened to have been a girl. But it doesn't feel very reliable, right? So we can make up some kind of a numerical score that would basically say, if you're asking a split that's going to put a very small number of people in one of the categories, be very suspicious. It's probably the case that you're learning something very quirky about the particular people that you're training on. So you don't want people to be too small, a group of people to be in one of the splits. And another thing is you'd like the splits to be as pure as possible. By pure, I mean, once you've gone down one of the branches, you want it to do a good job of separating the boys from the girls. Asking a question that gives you two even splits and they're both mixed, boys and girls, doesn't really tell you anything. So what people who design learning algorithms for this form of classifier do is they make up scoring functions that say things like the splits that divide the groups mostly evenly and very pure on both sides are good splits. And of all the possible splits you can make, choose the best one. So in this data, if you do that, that's the rule that you get at the very top of the tree. I'm going to draw the tree so that we have some idea of what it's actually creating. Now, you know, at this point, I'm using some of my own judgment, but it's really not hard at all to write a program that just does this without any person intervening. The program just runs on the data, it tries different things, and then it spits out something like what we're gonna have. All right. So the first question was, are you 5 feet to 5 feet three? Horrible diamond. Some people, the answer will be yes, and some people, the answer will be no. Now, in this case, if the answer is yes, according to our data, there's only 6 people out of the 17 that would answer yes to that question, and all of them are girls. So at this point, there's really no more work to do. If the answer to this is yes, then we're going to guess girl. Okay? Now, on the other end, why is that? It's because we had in this category, we had, boy, what was it? 7 girls and 10 boys. And I apologize for using the boy-girl, it's a little easier to say. I know you're not boys and girls, per se. 10 boys, all right. So here, when we answer yes, we get 6 girls and no boys. So that's pretty good. On the other hand, if the answer is no, what do we get? How many people answer no to this? Well, we can actually figure it out from what's on the board. There would be 1 girl and 10 boys. Now, at this point, we could say it's a pretty good bet. Anybody in this category is a boy. But let's see if we can come up with one more question that would do a good job of splitting just these guys up. So the way we can do that now is we can say, all right, let's not look at everyone anymore. Let's just look at the people who match for question 2, they say A. Actually, we want the not match. We want the people who say no to question A. Sorry, they say not A to question 2. Did I do that right? I did not do that right. Oh, it's unmatched, not no, sorry. All right, so what it's doing now, it's going through making the same set of splits, but on a smaller group of people, just people who've answered no, not A to the question, are you 5 foot to 5'3"? And what we discover here is that we get, you know, for example, question 0, which now I've erased again. Anybody remember what question 0 was? Well, that was the height question. So, of the people who answered no to the question not between 5 foot and 5'3", what about if we ask the question, are you between 5'6" and 5'9"? So here we get, if the answer is yes, we get 2 boys and 1 girl, and if the answer is no, we get 8 boys. Is that a good split? I don't know, it's still we have this boy mixed in with the girls. It would be nice to kind of peel her off from the rest. It turns out, if we go through all these different questions, the one that ends up scoring the best is this one. Question 4, if the answer is A, we get the girl. If question 4, if the answer is not A, we get all the boys. Anybody remember what that question was?
Hair dryer,
right. So use hair dryer. Yes, no. Did I say this was 1 girl and boys? We ask this question. If we go down the yes branch of use hair dryer, then we get 1 girl. If we answer no, we get all 10 boys. So if we had to guess at this point, we would say all these people are girls and all these people are boys. So that's our decision tree. This is the decision tree that was learned fairly automatically from the data that we collected at the end of class last time. And what it says is, okay, for people in this class, if you want to figure out if they're a boy or a girl, find out if they're, I don't want to say short, but in the shortest fifth of the class. If they're in that shortest fifth, they're girls. If not, then you need to ask another question. Do they use a hairdryer? If the answer is yes, you've still got a girl. Otherwise, you've got a boy. So when I ask this question to the people in my household, you have to say, you know, 5'3 or below, because we have some people below 5 feet. Of the people below 5 feet, one of them's a girl, one of them's a boy, so there's one error. Of the people that are above 5'3, is that just me? No, it might be me and my spouse, and she uses a hairdryer and I don't. So it does the rest of us correctly. So what I'd like to know is there's some people, now I know that everybody who is here and clicked is correctly categorized by this tree, because that's when I stopped. I stopped when I got 100% correct on the data that I already collected. But there are some people here who didn't get a chance to click in at the end of class. I want to know whether or not this works for them. So if you weren't in the 17 that I have data for, can you raise your hand? We have, okay, all right, so four of you, great. Okay, so the four of you, do this list, and if it works, put your hand up. Awesome. So it generalizes. It correctly generalizes. Does it work for you, Monica?
No.
No? How tall are you?
I'm 5'4".
You're 5'4".
And I don't use a hairdryer.
So you're a boy. I'm sorry. All right. So I'm sorry that I had to tell you this way, but you know, machines don't lie. They're just machines. All right, so it didn't work for Monica, but it presumably works for you, I guess. Oh, I guess you could use a hairdryer. You're definitely taller than 5'3".
Yeah, I don't use a hairdryer.
All right, so we got him as well. All right, so anybody have any questions about this? I thought this ended up being a much nicer demonstration than I thought it would be. I wish it worked in real time. I wish I could just collect the clicks and have it draw the tree up on the screen and be done with it. But the input that I got from you guys about what kind of questions to ask was really great. It was much more clever and useful than the stuff that I was thinking. So I thought this worked really well. Any questions? Do you sort of get the basic picture? All we have to do is if we change the questions, we could also predict which of you are going to kill people, according to the study that we read last time.
Let's do that.
What's that? Let's do that? I'm not sure. No. I'm not sure I want to know. I'm hoping that, you know, that we won't have enough examples of the positive examples of killers, and so therefore this won't work. For example, if we wanted to predict from this, like, who was going to grow up to be in professional sports or something like that, we can't do that because we don't have, we don't know what the answers are yet. We need to know how to build this tree so that they're good at predicting the answers that we have in our training set. So you have to ask questions that you have a complete set of data for, including the labels. All right, anybody else? Feedback on that, thoughts? I thought that was really neat. All right, so let me switch over to turn the clicker thing back on, and we'll collect a couple questions, and then I'll dive into genetic algorithms.
Can I borrow a clicker?
Sure.
It's lost in my car.
It's lost in your car. Does it beep or something if you? No. All right, so last time we talked about learning. We ended up talking about two different kinds of learning algorithms. One was a perceptron, or a neural network. Then I talked about decision trees. I told you about the classifiers of decision trees, but then I actually built the decision tree for you today based on data that we collected in class. But just to, you know, remind you of what we talked about last time, when a perceptron learns, what changes? Where does its knowledge get stored? Is it in the weights of the network? Is it in the neural net? Is it in the input layer? Is it in its database, or is it in its neocognitron? No, no chuckling from the TAs. That may give things away.
Have you ever heard that word?
I mean, maybe.
Yeah, it's been a long time ago, but it meant something like this.
Ooh, positronic network. That's what data had, right? From Star Wars?
From
Star Trek?
From Asimov's robot head.
Oh, really?
So Data from the Android from Star Trek had a positronic neural network. They actually used the phrase neural network. All right, five more seconds. Four, three, two, one. Click away. Stopping. All right, so in a neural network, the only thing that changes are the weights. The input layer is just a bunch of units, and they're always the same. There's nothing there. The neural net is the whole thing. That doesn't really tell you anything. It doesn't have a database per se, and a neocognitron is a word that was in papers in the 50s, but I never really found out what it meant, but it sounds cool. Neo meaning new, cognitron meaning thought something, thought machine, new thought machine. So the answer is weights. Okay. All right, any questions, comments? May I proceed? I will proceed. All right, a program that turns input objects into class labels, 0, 1, is called a decision tree, neural net, training set, linear separator, classifier. So this is basically what the output of a learning algorithm does. A learning algorithm takes some kind of information, like the stuff that we clicked in on, it grinds away for a while and it produces one of these things, things that take new objects and guesses whether the label should be 0 or 1. 0, 1, like boy, girl. So what do we call, generically, something that has that property, that functionality? Seconds. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. All right, stopping. So a decision tree is this. A decision tree does map input objects into zeros and ones, or in this case, boys and girls. But that's just one particular kind of thing like this. There's lots of other ways to do it. A neural net is another one. Neural nets can be used to separate things into zeros and ones. Training set is what the input to a learning algorithm is. That's a different thing. Linear separators also split things into zeros and ones, but it's just one particular kind. Generically, altogether, those things are called classifiers. So classification learning, classifier learning is about turning a training set into a classifier. There's lots of different kinds of classifiers. And we talked about two of them. So the answer was E. Though again, decision tree, neural net, and linear separator, which are the only other ones that people chose, are in fact types of classifiers. You know, sort of like if I asked, what is a four-wheeled vehicle? And I said, you know, an SUV, a Ford, a Pontiac, and a car. So car is sort of the answer that catches the definition the best. Alrighty. Alright, good. So that's it with that. Any last questions or comments about learning algorithms per se before I dive into the last chapter? I will do so. So the last chapter of the book, Hillis pitches it a particular way, but mostly what he's talking about are genetic algorithms. Genetic algorithms are a kind of program, style of programming, for solving particular kinds of problems that involve optimization, that involve searching around, trying to find the best of something according to some rule. One of the things I thought was interesting about this is the connection between, there's an analogy drawn between biological evolution and the search in a computer for more fit individuals or more high-scoring individuals or better answers. And it's a very appealing, interesting kind of analogy, but it is just an analogy. So let me give you a little background. when I was an undergrad, at one point I saw advertisements for an outside speaker, some guy from Michigan who was going to come and give a talk about a topic. And I thought, okay, well, I'm not registered for that class. It wasn't a class, but I always think about things in terms of classes. It wasn't a class I was registered for, so I was very reluctant to go. But somebody managed to kind of nudge me and convince me that I should try this out. So I made sure to sit all the way in the back. And this guy came to talk, his name is John Holland, very famous guy, and basically the progenitor, or the creator of this whole field of genetic algorithms. And he was great. He was so interesting. He was such an inspiring guy. He laid out the problem. He explained how it was. It was, a lot of it went over my head, but a lot of it, I could tell what was exciting about it and what was useful about it, and it made me want to go and learn some more. And so it's definitely something that you could think about doing while you're an undergrad. Don't do it. If you see advertisements for talks and they seem interesting, you don't have to already know what it's about. You don't have to be registered for anything. They're open to people, especially people who are at the university. And taking advantage of things like that, you can hear some really bright people talk about some really interesting things. So I definitely would urge you to take advantage of that at some point while you're an undergrad. But nevertheless, that was my first introduction to this idea of genetic algorithms. I later ended up publishing in the field and being involved in it in various ways, but mostly as an outsider. They're really interesting. They're a lot of fun. There's a lot of power to them. They haven't completely lived up to their promise. Certainly, when Holland was talking about it, it was like, we are this close to solving the whole AI problem if we just apply these genetic algorithms to it. And it turned out that wasn't the case. But they still turn out to be useful and interesting. One of the ways that they're referred to disparagingly is as the second best way to solve any problem. So a lot of problems have a form that where genetic algorithms could be applied to them. And they always do well, but they never do the best. And generally, if you have a problem that you want to solve, you don't want to do this because you want to use whatever is the best way to solve it. So, nevertheless, it's cool to think about it, and it's exciting, so I would like to try to share it with you. So, this is the way that Hillis pitches it. He says, okay, think about brains. Brains have on the order of 10 to the 12th neurons, and each neuron is connected to like 10 to the 5th, like 10,000 other neurons. So there's a million million neurons. Oh yeah, that's 10 to the 12th. So a million million neurons, each with 100,000 connections. So multiply those two together, and that's the number of connection pairs that you get somewhere in the brain. That's amazing. That's a lot of connectivity. It's a lot of complexity. It turns out that we now know that there's some areas that the brain is not just sort of one amorphous computery blob. There actually are areas that are specialized to do different things. There's there's an area that's referred to as Broca's area, after a guy named Broca, who first identified it. And as far as we can tell, it seems to be very important in producing grammatical speech. So if people who have Broca's area damaged end up speaking in very broken kind of sentences, that you know what they're trying to say, but they can't quite make beautifully flowing sentences. Turns out there's another brain area in the mirror position on the other side of the brain called Wernicke's area that has the property that when that is damaged, people still can speak completely flowingly, but it's all gibberish. It's just complete nonsense. So it's sort of the yin-yang kind of parts of the language areas of the brain. Now, you have to be a little careful here. Here's what we do know. We do know that patients who present to the hospital with damage to Broca's area speak brokenly. They have trouble forming nicely flowing sentences. But you can guess that maybe that area is therefore connected with the production of nicely flowing sentences. But you can take this kind of argument too far. So this is, I don't know if you noticed, in the beginning of the semester I tried to tell a joke and it ended up falling very flat. I'm not any good at, say, joke telling per se. This is a joke that if I tried to do it out loud, no one would laugh at the end. But I tried to write it out. Maybe this will work better. We'll see. All right, so there was this biologist who was doing some experiments on frogs. He was measuring just how far frogs could jump. So he puts the frog on a starting line and he says, jump, frog, jump. And the frog jumps 2 feet. So he writes down in his lab notebook, frog with four legs jumps 2 feet. Now it gets a little gruesome. He chops off one of the legs. This didn't really happen. Nobody hurts frogs, don't worry. He chops off one of the legs of the frog and then repeats the experiment. Puts the frog on the line, says, jump, frog, jump. The frog manages to jump a foot and a half, not quite as far as before. So he writes down in his lab notebook, frog with three legs jumps 1.5 feet. Then he chops off another foot and the frog only jumps 1 foot. Sorry, 1 foot in distance. He writes in his notebook, frog with two legs jumps 1 foot. He continues and moves another leg, jump, frog, jump. Now, the frog has just one leg, but it does manage to go 6 inches, so he writes, frog with one leg jumps half a foot, finally chops off the last leg, and he says, jump, frog, jump! And the frog doesn't move, so he says, jump, frog, jump! And the frog just stays there, and suddenly, come on, frog, jump! So then he writes down in his lab notebook, frog with no legs goes down. So, again, just because you have damage in a particular area of the brain, and that stops you from doing something, doesn't mean that that's something is exactly what it is that that you thought it was. And so there's a lot of scientists now working on this sort of thing. What's cool now, compared to when Broca and Wernicke did their work, when Broca and Wernicke did their stuff, the way that you do these experiments is you'd wait for someone to have some horrible brain damage. Like this guy Phineas Gage, who had a spike that went through part of his head, and he was fine, but he had this metal spike through his head. And his personality completely changed. And so the people said, okay, well, we know what part of the brain that went through, so maybe it's related to the change in behavior. What we can do now, though, scientists now have these fMRI machines, these giant magnets that they used originally for diagnosing people. They now put people in these machines and then do psych experiments on them, where they ask them questions, and then they can actually peer inside their brain and look at the areas of the brain that are more active. They're using up more blood. They're requiring more blood, more oxygen to keep going, and they assume that there's some kind of connection between which areas of the brain are more active and the kinds of questions that they're being asked to solve, people are asked to solve. And so we're getting more and more precise notions, and what they're learning is that all these brain areas are much more complicated than people were guessing. There's parts of Broca's area that are important for this, and there's parts of Wernicke, it's much more sloppy and messy and not so clean. Furthermore, functions can shift around. So, at least to some extent, it seems as though that if, especially when you're very, very young, if a part of your brain gets damaged that's responsible, generally responsible for some sort of narrow but important function, with enough exposure and enough learning and enough stimulation of various sorts, people can still learn to carry out those functions. And if you look in their brain, you find out that that work is now being done someplace else, someplace where it wasn't intended to be, where it intended, someplace where it wouldn't normally be done in other people, and probably wouldn't have been done there if that person's part of the brain hadn't been damaged. Just as another aside, so my son, when he was born, had a little bit of brain damage. He was born 3 months early. He was this tiny little 1-pound scrawny little chicken thing. But he lived, and he's doing quite well. But later, after when he was maybe 2 or 3 and he was exhibiting certain kinds of weird behavior patterns, they scanned his brain, and they found that there was a little black hole exactly in the part of the brain that you'd think would be responsible for the sorts of behaviors that he was having trouble with. A lot of visual integration things, like seeing a visual pattern and understanding it. But, you know, he was still our son, so we're not going to, like, throw him away or anything. So, we just continue to love him and stimulate him in various ways. And now it's very, very difficult. He's weird, but he's weird like the way I'm weird. Presumably, I don't have brain damage that I'm aware of. So it's genetic and not due to the fact that he was born early. Somehow, he's managed to kind of work around that hole, and he seems to be doing really fine. So I really believe in this. I believe in this idea that there are areas, they do have special functions, but brains are pretty flexible, and they can learn, different parts of the brain can learn to do different things. And so what I get from this, and this is what Hillis talked about in the chapter, there doesn't seem to be a very clean hierarchical functional breakdown of the sort that you'd see if you peer into a microprocessor. If you look at an actual computer chip, you can actually identify where is the memory, where is the math happening, where is the connection to peripherals. It's really nice and clean. And why? Because it was designed to be that way, right? The people who actually created the chip said, okay, this is the part of the chip where we're going to do this kind of function. But you look in a brain and it's not so clean. It's not so crisp and crispy. And Hillis is very inspired by this idea. So he spent a lot of time designing systems and thinking about how systems work, but he's ultimately sort of frustrated about them. And in particular, he points out that when people write software that does some very complicated, pretty amazing things, but still, it does not seem to be nearly as robust as our brain or birds or crickets. I mean, they get around in the world. If they get stuck, they get themselves unstuck. If you damage them, then they heal in various ways. And he says, this is not the way that engineered artifacts have these catastrophic problems, and they don't fix themselves, and that's just the way things go. So I went online and I collected a bunch of examples where I want to say bad. I don't want to say badly written software, because this, some of the software is as good as anybody's ever written any software. But even the best written software has had some pretty amazingly scary problems or bugs that have caused them to behave in bad ways. So this is one that's very, very recent. This was published this past September. Injury risk prompts recall of Segways. People know what Segways are? These two-wheeled devices with a stick and a handlebar, and you kind of lean forward a little bit, and then it scoots you around about the speed that you could do on a bicycle, but really without any effort at all. When these first came out a bunch of years ago, the guy who invented them, Dean Kamen, I think, said that this was going to revolutionize transportation because it's you know, almost as fast like a car, but you can bring it indoors and it does all these amazing things. They didn't end up being quite so popular. Nevertheless, they're pretty neat. I've never ridden on one. I've seen them, but the people, it's kind of better connected geeks than me who have ridden on these things, say that they're really, really neat. But it turns out, I think President Bush fell off of these ones. And that was a software problem, as it turned out, a firmware problem, that the Segway, when it was very low on battery, started to act a little peculiarly. And there was nothing in it that said, when your battery starts to act, or when the battery starts to go down, just really try to tell people to go away until it gets charged again. So they fixed that after, I don't think they injured the president, but it's really bad form for a company to make the president fall on the ground. So, but this one apparently is a bit more dangerous. After six Segway riders complained of head and wrist injuries, the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission announced Thursday that in conjunction with the company, all 23,500 of the vehicles that they've sold since March 2002, in other words, ever, until mid-September, are being voluntarily recalled. So the company is taking them all back. And so the way that it's described in this article, anyway, according to the manufacturer, the speed limiter in a Segway can cause it to tip backwards suddenly, throwing off the rider. The company has already devised a fix for this bug, and the owners encouraged to contact the company for information on obtaining the software upgrade. So here's a machine that's hurting people, and it's just because there's a problem with the software, or at least it's fixable just by changing the software. So that's a pretty small example. People hurting their wrists is maybe a bit of a bummer. Was that a question?
Are they doing good? Because
the company, I don't think. Well, so he's been. Kamen is starting to show up on TV shows now, talking about his other inventions. I think that he thought this was going to be his Model T. He was going to be an inventor for all of history, but it didn't work out that way. So now he's pushing other things out the door. So I don't know. I think the company still exists. I think it's a small company. It's not trying to do that much, but they really do want their big breakthrough that everyone's going to want. This wasn't it. As cool as it is, it's more cool than fundamentally useful. All right, so that was one example. These are other, I think I might have got these off of Wikipedia, but there was a list of really horrible problems that have occurred in history due to bad software. And it's sort of funny, but it's also sort of sad. So Therac 25, so this was a machine that people would use for radiation treatment. Doctors would use it to treat patients who had cancers that would beam radiation directly onto the tumor and kill the tumor without killing the patient. Well, it turns out that if you typed too fast on the machine, that the software that was collecting the keystrokes to decide what exactly the radiation machine should be doing would end up double counting in various ways and double dosing the patient with radiation. And so people were dying, and the company was saying, What? We just sell the machine. It's just a machine. And the operator's saying, what? We're just typing in the machine the way that we're told to type in the machine. But somebody eventually traced it down and said, yes, you thought this actually worked, but a perfectly reasonable way of using your program causes it to do this horrible thing. The Patriot missile tracking system. The Patriot missile tracking system was used, certainly in the first Gulf War quite a bit, for trying to shoot down incoming missiles, which, you know, you want that to work. And it actually has to be done extremely precisely. It turns out the time, to get the timing just right, was measured in tenths of a second. And it turns out that when you try to put exactly a tenth of a second as a binary number, you can't do it exactly. Same way you can't do one-third as an exact decimal number, you can't do one-tenth exact as a binary number. So they round it. and that round-off error caused it, as it was actually tracking the missile, as it was running, just sitting on the ground tracking missiles, over a period of hours, days, multiple days, it would start to lose precision because these tenths of a second would add up wrong.
There was actually an order that went out to the troops to power cycle the machine.
Right, so that's right. So the fix for this bug is Every, do you know how often they can do
it? Either every 12 or 24 hours.
So every day, every half day, you actually powered down your Patriot missile shooter tracker launcher thing, and then powered up again, because now it's zeroed, right? Now it's we know that it's accurate because it's starting off, everything's starting off at zero, and it'll slowly drift. And 12 hours later, you shut it down, and then it's synchronized again, and it starts to drift again. But they were actually missing, like, missiles were coming at the troops, and these Patriot missile launchers were supposed to stop them, and sometimes they wouldn't, because it would be off by a couple of degrees, and then the missile would land on people. Maybe they shouldn't have used tenths of a second as the unit. Maybe they should have used something that could be represented exactly. We've lost a lot of things on Mars, and a lot of these seem to be due to software errors. Though if you read the right websites, it has nothing to do with that. It's the hidden Martians that are on the back of Mars that are purposely stealing our technology. But for as far as we know, it may actually be due to software. So the Mars Climate Orbiter lost on entry into the Martian atmosphere because the code, the actual program, inconsistently used feet and meters. So they have a variable that said something like distance equals 6. And in some parts of the code, that meant 6 feet. And in some parts of the code, that meant 6 meters. And so if you're trying to, you know, have a rocket ship that's actually orbiting Mars, and it occasionally thinks that it's thinking in meters and not feet, the numbers are just going to be wrong, and it's going to screw up. But eventually it ended up crashing through the atmosphere and then being obliterated on the planet someplace. It's one of those things that where I've written a lot of programs with a lot of bugs, but usually when my programs crash, I watch them crash and I say, oh darn, that was a couple hours of work and now I need to figure out what's going wrong. This is like, you know, $1 billion spacecraft that you can't get back because it's like very far away. Mars Polar Lander was a similar sort of thing, though in this case the software misinterpreted the extension of its landing legs as landing, causing an engine shutdown. So it's heading towards the surface of the planet, and then part of the software says, okay, kick out the legs so that there's something to land on. That bumped the machine a little bit, and some other part of the software said, oh, a bump, I landed, and it shut down the engine. And then the thing went, yeah, splat. You know, you imagine you're the guy or gal who wrote that line of code thinking, maybe someone should have tested this before we send it to Mars. Just to say that this doesn't only happen in the U.S. The Ariane 5 rocket, satellite launch missile software couldn't convert a 16-bit real number to a 16-bit integer and crashed in flight. So basically what happened is, one way to write programs that are robust is you, whenever there's an error in the signal, you have something sitting outside that in the code that catches the error. But basically what happens is there's a part of the code that's responsible to say, you know what, something in the code that was running in here has gone wrong, now it's my job to do whatever has to be done. And so all the different things that you might think might go wrong, you try to write something to catch all those errors. Well, one that they didn't catch was, if you have a 16-bit real number, you can represent very, very, very large numbers that way. 16-bit integers, you can only represent things up to 2 to the 16th power. It's like 65,536. If you try to take a really big number and put it into 16 bits, you'll get some kind of overflow. And so, which is fine, the code then said, you know what, I can't do this. It threw the error and nobody caught it. So the rocket just stopped. It was already partway up and tilted and it just shut itself down. Like, okay, I don't know what to do in this case. And so the software didn't get caught, and by the way, neither did the rocket. It went kooey. So, you know, you don't see birds doing this sort of thing, right? It's like flying along and all of a sudden there's like a 3-bit error and then it goes and it just drops to the ground. Those birds don't get to have baby birds. But that's not true of the things that we build. So what Hella says is the problem here is the way that we build, the way we engineer things, the way we write software. We write different pieces separately and then we don't always fully test them all together. Now, building things separately is the only way that we know how to build things. Because if we had to build it all in one bit, if we had to write, you know, program all the billions of transistors that are in the computer, if we had to do them all at the same time, we'd be kind of stuck. So what we really need to do, and this is the idea of reduction that I keep coming back to through the semester, this is like the fundamental insight of computer science, is that we want to build something that has some functionality and then seal it off and say, we're done with this piece, we're just going to use it for whatever it's good for. And now we build this piece and we're going to use it for what it's good for. And then we're going to combine them and use that for what it's good for. And sometimes in the combination, we make a mistake. And the only way we can catch that is by testing things together as a unit. So Hella says that the only way that we know how to do this from an engineering standpoint now, and this is not generally what's done, is by building systems in a more holistic way, which is too hard for our puny little brains. So we need something like genetic algorithms. We need computers to actually search through the space of possible engineering designs to find things that are going to be robust. And the way we'll make sure that they're robust is we'll try them in the world and make sure they do what they're supposed to do. If they crash, we don't let those rockets have babies. It's as simple as that. All right, so here's the GA story in a nutshell. So what we're going to do is we're trying to find the answer to a question. So what would be a good answer to a question? We're trying to find a, one perfectly reasonable thing is we're trying to find a good decision tree. We've got a bunch of data. There's lots of different trees that have this form. We can ask different first questions. We can go down different numbers of steps in depth. We can assign the leaves to boy and girl differently. Each of these, we're going to pretend, is we're going to call these individuals. An entire decision tree is an individual. We're actually going to have multiple, we're going to consider multiple different individuals as possible solutions to the problem of which one does the best job of separating the boys from the girls. So we're going to call that, in GA terminology, a population. We have a whole bunch of individuals all hanging out together. All right. And we have to set the size of that population to some number, let's say 200. So we've got 200 possible decision trees for solving a problem. Now what we have to do is figure out which ones are good and which ones aren't. And we call the objective function score the fitness. So what we're going to do is take each of those decision trees and test them out. See how well they do. Maybe some combination of how accurate they are minus how big they are. Because it's easy to make accurate decision trees if you make them really, really, really large. But the really large ones aren't good because they're kind of slow, but they're also a little over-specific. Like if we had a decision tree that just memorized each person's name in the class and said whether they were a boy or a girl, it wouldn't generalize very well. So we need a scoring function. We need some way of saying how good a decision tree is. And it's going to combine these different features. And fitness, this word is again taken from biology. We talk about how fit animals are, how good they are matched to their environments. So higher objective function values or higher fitnesses, the solutions that have higher fitnesses are going to be replicated. We're going to make copies of them to allow more search to proceed from these examples. So it's essentially like asexual reproduction. So we've got a population of 200 individuals. Some of them are better than others according to the scoring function. The good ones, we let them have babies. We let them make copies of themselves. And the bad ones, we're going to just get rid of. We're going to let them crash and die. But that's not going to be good enough because really all this is going to do, if we just repeat this process over and over again, whichever decision tree is the best one in the population is going to eventually take over the entire population. We'll just have a bunch of clones of it. And clones, that's not really going to be a very effective way of searching the space. So what we're going to do is have local search steps. We're going to take an individual and make subtle modifications to it. Make, you know, change one of the leaves from boy to girl, or flip the yeses and nos, or move two things, or take this one out and put a different one in. Just small changes to something that we think is already good. And in GA land, we call those mutations. Again, by analogy to biological evolution. The optimization then proceeds over a series of iterations, but in GA speak, they call them generations, you know, as if they're having babies one after the other. And then they have this other very cute idea. And John Holland in particular was a huge fan of this. He thought this was great, but it turns out to be sort of mixed. But he says, what we can do is if we've got two different decision trees, and they're both good, but neither of them are great, we let them have sex. We let them combine pieces of each other to create babies that have elements from both of the individuals that were scoring well. Now, intuitively, that seems like a brilliant idea, right? And in some problems, it actually works incredibly well. That we end up getting, you know, the good things from this parent and the good things from this parent. He called this crossover, and in fact, when most animals reproduce, the genetic code of the children ends up being pieces of the father and pieces of the mother. And the genetic sequences cross over like that. They split in one place and then they reconnect to each other. So we can do this in terms of individuals in a simulated population as well. We can call it crossover. We can call it sex. We can call it mating, whatever we want to do. And then what we do is, again, we just repeat this. The fit individuals are allowed to have sex and make babies, and the unfit individuals are not. We just take them out of the population and we don't spend any more time on them. So you can see that the thought process here is very much the Darwinian model of how evolution can proceed, but it's applied completely on these simulated objects, completely mathematically. Okay, any questions or comments about that? No? Seems sort of clear. I always thought this was really fun to talk about because you get to say sex a couple times. But that seemed to have no, I got no rise out of anybody on that. All right, let me try another story. So once upon a time, when I was a young researcher, I went to my very first conference, and it was a genetic algorithms conference, and I was scheduled to give a presentation on, you know, my first research paper. And so, you know, I was very excited. So I was sitting on the plane next to this guy, big guy, maybe, you know, 6'3 or so, strong looking, with a big cowboy hat. And he seemed like a friendly enough guy, so I, you know, tried to get him to ask me where I was going, because I just was so excited I wanted to tell everybody. So anyway, I managed to get his attention, and I managed to, you know, it's like, where are you going? Is it the first time that you're doing anything? So finally he turned the questions around and asked me, I'm like, I'm going to a conference, I'm going to present my research, and I'm sure you'd be happy to hear about it. The salesman guy who probably doesn't care about computers. And I told him all about, you know, genetic algorithms and how we were searching for different solutions in the space of possibilities. And he listened. He was really polite. He just listened and just shaking his head. But he said, you know, I just have one question for you. What if it turns out that evolution isn't real? And I didn't know what to say to that because it was just such a weird question on so many different levels. First of all, I had never really considered the possibility that the biological explanation of evolution wasn't a reasonable thing to think is happening. But even apart from that, this isn't biological evolution. So what I said to him after a moment's thought was, well, even if it's not real, this is all just in the computer, and I know what it's doing, and it's doing what I wanted to do, and so it's not, it doesn't matter whether evolution is real or not. It's still a good idea for searching in complex search spaces. Anyway, we didn't talk for the rest of the trip. It was really very illuminating to me in a lot of different ways. All right, so there's, it turns out that this general framework for how you might do search is really just a framework, and there's lots of ways of turning this into a concrete problem. If you're actually going to apply it to something that you care about, like maybe the classification problem or scheduling your classes, it also can be looked at this way. Each different schedule is a different individual, and if you've got two schedules that seem pretty good, you might let them mate with each other. All right, like that. So, but you have to answer a couple questions. First of all, what is the fitness function? How are you going to score individuals so that the ones that you like are going to get high scores, and the ones that you don't like are going to have low scores? And there's lots of different ways you can do that. How is an individual represented? How is it that you take your schedule and write it down in the computer? How are individuals selected for reproduction? How do you decide which ones do get to mate? You know, obviously the attractive ones. But what is, you know, that's defined by fitness. And in particular, one way of doing it is actually taking the whole population and killing off the bottom half and just letting the top half mate, fill the bottom half. There's roulette wheel selection. There's lots of different ways that you can imagine doing this. What you don't want to do though is do it by straight lottery, because then the high-scoring individuals and the low-scoring individuals all get an equal chance, and you're not going to put the search energy into the high-scoring individual. How do you change individuals? How do you alter them? What does the mutation operator look like? How are individuals combined? What is it like for them to have sex? You know, do they have a cigarette afterwards? That sort of thing. All right, so I'm trying here. All right. Is this question at all interesting? Let me see. I like this concrete example better than the one that I have in the notes. So let me just flip through that. Right. So we can actually code this up in various ways. Here's an actual little snippet of Python that implements a genetic algorithm. We start off. We run some code that's actually create the original population, just make up random individuals. We're going to count the number of generations that have gone by, and we're going to stop when things stop changing. And while things aren't done, we're going to thin out the population. In this case, what I wrote, this thin function that I wrote, sorts all the individuals by fitness, and then kills off the bottom half. Then we take the winner, that's the one whose fitness is at the top of the sorted list, and we let it reproduce by picking a random individual from the population from 0 to m minus 1. What is m? M's not even defined here. I think that's the number of individuals in the population. We pick some at random and make them the mate. We create that new individual. We mutate that individual. Then we print who's got the highest score in the whole population. If the winner has the absolute right optimal score for this problem, then we're done. Otherwise, we increment how many generations we've gone, and we go back to the top. We just keep repeating this over and over again. We kill off half of everybody, and then we mate the first half into the holes left by the ones that were killed off. We just repeat that over and over again. Here's actual code for mating. It doesn't look as good in Python as it does in real life. Mutating, thinning out the population. It takes, it sorts the population by their fitness, and then returns the, well, in this case, it's the bottom half. So I guess, oh, because these are sorted in increasing order. Right, so this sort puts the dopes, the rejects in the front, and the really great ones in the back, and then throws out everything except for the back. So one of the things that I think is neat about this, and the reason I flashed code up in front of you, even though probably you never have to implement this on your own, is that it actually has elements of almost everything that we've talked about this semester. So it serves as kind of a good reminder of the various things that we touched on. It's got loops in it, because it has to keep repeating this population operation over and over again. Each individual is a string, or it can be represented as a list. We did sorting, remember sorting? Sorting, in this case, to try to figure out who to kill. Random numbers, I said, were really useful. It turns out that they very much drive search in this case. If we're letting random individuals mate with other random individuals to create random babies, it tends to kind of produce a lot of different examples, a lot of search. Things are represented in terms of bits. We talked about bits in the beginning. We didn't get to talk about search and hill climbing, but that's important here, too. And this can actually be done with a lot of parallelism. If you have 200 individuals, and you need a score for each of them. If you had 200 processors, each one could evaluate one individual, send the answers back, and then it'll run 200 times faster. So it's a nice opportunity to do things in parallel. So let's see. By way of demos, so here's what I'd like to do with the remaining time. I'm going to show you two cool videos, and I'm going to show you a debate between Hillis and another guy. But here, let me, what is it that we're looking at here? This is there's a guy named Carl Sims who worked for the company that Hillis founded. And all this work was done on Hillis's computer, actually. He evolved simulated individuals, and the fitness function was, how far can they swim? And he simulated the swimming in the computer and then animated it with computer graphics. And these are the sorts of things that came popping out of his genetic algorithm. They're just so cool. They're like, you know, tadpoles and eels, and they're all being discovered just through this process of letting the individuals that could transport themselves the furthest were reproduced. This one is walking by just by shaking itself around. This one's rolling. So the structure of the blocks is specified by the genetic algorithm, and the behavior at the joints are also specified by the genetic algorithm. That one's not very effective, but it's really cool looking. Yeah, it's almost like the butterfly. Nice. I don't know why. I don't know why. So again, these are the fitness function for these guys is how far can they transport themselves in some small number of seconds. So he would simulate them for some number of seconds, measure the distance traveled by the center of mass, and then use that as a fitness function, and let the ones that were more successful mate and produce these crazy gorilla babies. Now these guys are being scored by how high they get up off the ground. What's the height of their center of mass? This one is being scored by how well it goes to a point. You can see this red dot here. So it actually has to change its behavior depending on its relative position of it and the target. So these evolving target followers. Again, this is kind of in the water simulated environment. One thing that he did say is that his creatures would tend to discover bugs in his simulator. So at one point, his simulation didn't conserve momentum. And so one individual learned to move itself just by beating itself in the head repeatedly, and it would get faster and faster as it did that. It doesn't happen that way in physics, but his fake physics, it's exactly what happened. Is that all we got with that? There was another set of things that he did where They were scored on, it was like a sumo match, and they were scored on who would be left in the circle, and they'd be random individuals would be paired up and they'd compete with each other. And so they learned all kinds of neat strategies, like one involved just to be really, 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 really big. And it would just stand at the edge of the circle, and when the game started, it would just collapse into the circle. And so anything that was in there would probably get squirted out, and so it was very hard to beat. But just such a neat, yeah, Thinking Machines Corp. So this was Hellas's company where this was done. Anyway, so that was very cute. What I'd like to do now is, I thought that Hillis's philosophy of all this genetic algorithm stuff was really interesting. So what I'd like to do, especially in light of, there's a lot of debate in certainly the popular press, I don't know how much of it is happening in other places, about evolution and intelligent design. And what I thought was really neat is there was a lot of things that Hillis said. Now, Hillis isn't really weighing in on the whole question of what's really happening in the biological world. He's mostly interested in building things that do cool stuff. But as a result, he has his own opinions about how things should be done. I also found a bunch of quotes from this guy, Michael Behe. He's a PhD in biochemistry. He's a professor at Lehigh. And he is a fellow of the Discovery Institute. That's the folks that push this intelligent design idea. They both look at the same world around them, and they come to very different conclusions. But the way that they think is actually really sort of neat. So what I'd like to do is just kind of step you through these ideas. Oh, I pulled together bios for them. So Hillis did his work in computer science. He invented the connection machine, 64,000 processor machine. He also invented the 10,000-year clock. After he left Thinking Machines, when he was at Disney, he said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to design something that will keep accurate time for 10,000 years. With no intervention from people and so forth. And it turns out it's actually very, very hard to do, but it's very interesting to think through why. When is this going to fail? If you have a spring or something, when is that going to run out? Or a battery, when is that going to run out? If it's going to be driven by the sun, how are you going to make sure that if it's cloudy a couple days in a row, it doesn't lose time? So he had to really think this through, and I think it ended up being very big and made of stone. But nevertheless, then he went on to found a company called Applied Minds, and they just invent stuff, a lot of it for the military. And Behe, on the other hand, is an expert in biochemistry, and he studies within cells, the parts of the cells that perform different actions, like the cilia in animals that have cilia. All right, so they both had something to say about noticing when something's been designed or not. So here's what Behe said. He was talking about a car. He said, we look at a car, and we know that it was designed by some intelligent person or a group of people. You look under the hood and you see the engine, and you can just see that it's designed. So the patterns are such that it's just laid out really well. Strictly thought went into it. So Behe argues that things like cars were intelligently designed, and we probably don't have any disagreement there. Hillis, on the other hand, looks at a monkey brain, and this is in this chapter. He actually says this. He says, looking at it appears as if everything is connected to everything else. It's completely unlike the neat hierarchical diagram of an engineered computer. It doesn't look like it was designed. So Behe says machines were designed, and Hillis says that biology wasn't designed. They weren't quite talking about the same things. Still kind of interesting. All right, what about natural selection? They both believe that natural selection is a process that can do various sorts of things. But it turns out that they have completely opposite impressions of what they're good for. So Behe, by the way, Hillis has had some experience with genetic algorithms. He used his connection machine to search for sorting networks, optimal sequences of comparisons that will actually cause any list to become sorted. And he did this with a genetic approach. So he's published in that area. So he has actually tried to solve problems this way and ended up coming up with designs that were as good as the best design that people have come up with, but really hard to figure out why it is that they work at all. Not unlike a monkey brain as far as Hillis is concerned. All right, so Behe says, so natural selection is this idea that you figure out which things are most fit, and you keep those and you throw away the ones that are less fit, which is more or less the way that Darwin explained how species can come about and adapt. So Behe says, sure, natural selection is a real thing, but it's really only good for making small steps, small improvements. He says, some systems seem very difficult to form by successive modification, this kind of mutate and then select sort of thing. And he called those things irreducibly complex. He says natural selection can only choose among systems that are already working. So you shouldn't expect to be able to get a very unlikely series of discoveries happening all at once to create something that works really well. And so he argues things like a mousetrap or an eyeball have to be intelligently designed, because if you take out any of their working pieces, they stop working. You know, the frog goes deaf, sort of thing. Hillis, on the other hand, comes to exactly the opposite conclusion when he's thinking about natural selection in the computer context. He says that natural selection is good for making big steps, but it's actually a crappy way of making small improvements. It's exactly the opposite. He says simulated evolution is a good way to create novel structures, something entirely different than you had before, but it's an inefficient way to tune an existing design. If you have something that already works and you just want to make it more efficient, taking random changes to it and evaluating them is very slow and sloppy. Whereas there's much better ways of doing local search. You can actually make much more focused changes to make things better on a local scale. So they seem to disagree on that point. What about this idea of irreducible complexity? So here's what Beatty says. If a person were so unfortunate as to be missing one of the eye's many integrated features, they all work together to give you a working eye, you need the lens to be working, you need the iris of the eye to be doing its thing in the right way at the right time, ocular muscles that move the eye around, the inevitable result would be severe loss of vision. You wouldn't be able to see. And so that's why it must be that all these pieces were designed together at one time, because otherwise how could it possibly come to be that way? I think Hillis sort of agreed anyway, at least on the biological side. He said that building a nest requires a few dozen individual steps, such as, so this is a bird flying around making a nest. It's got to locate a twig, it's got to pick it up with its beak, it's got to carry the twig back to the nest. If any of those steps are missing, the bird doesn't get any advantage to nest building. So I guess they kind of agreed on that point. They disagreed about what it means to understand something. Beatty says that we're not allowed to say that we understand something, or maybe they agree on this as well. Some function is understood. Every relevant step in the process must be elucidated. We don't really understand. His claim is we don't understand evolution because there's parts of evolution that we just don't have a good story for yet, and therefore we throw out the whole thing, which seems a bit extreme. Hillis says that it's possible that a satisfactory description of what the brain does will be almost as complex as a description of the brain itself, in which case there's no meaningful sense in which we can say we understand it. So what Hillis is saying is there's plenty of things in nature that we're never going to have a good explanation for other than, you know, it works. Here's all the pieces and here's how they're arranged and it works. There's no way of breaking it down into smaller, easier to understand chunks. And he's okay with that, and I think Beatty is not okay with it. For whatever reason. These guys didn't actually debate directly. I'm just taking all their quotes out of context for humor value. All right, but when push comes to shove, they end up basically pointing at the other person's field to say where the answers lie. The grass is always greener. So Beatty, the biochemist, says, if the psyllium in a cell cannot be produced by natural selection, then it must have been designed. It must be that somebody built it, because that's the only way that you can get something so amazing and close. Hillis, on the other hand, who's an inventor, we also have to agree, he's an intelligent designer. He says that the things that we engineer are actually inherently fragile, like the Ariane rocket and so forth. They're always going to have these little quirks that cause them to break down. The contrast in reliability between brains and computers is a great example of the difference between the products of evolution and those of engineering. In other words, we can't build good things. It must be evolution. And Beatty says, evolution can't do good things. It must be invention. It must be engineering. So it kind of boils down to this. I think they're both being a little silly. They're trying to make something complex a little too simple. But what Hillis is really saying is that if he were God, we know he's not, and he may think he is, but we know he's not, he would design his creation by evolution. So it really boils down to this. Evolution, the choice of the intelligent designer. So here we've got a guy who knows the intelligent designer, and he's saying, I would use evolution. So again, he wasn't trying to sound off on this particular debate, and I guess I probably should apologize for even raising these issues, but I really just think it's interesting that people don't talk about it this way. People don't talk about it as, well, actually, if there is an intelligent designer, evolution might actually be the best way of doing what's been done. At least that's what Hillis thinks. All right, so that being said, let's see if I can, maybe I've got to get the sound up again. I think there's a couple more minutes. And what I'd like to do is show you this video by, actually, the guy whose birthday party I was going to when I lost my cell phone. But this was like 12 years ago.
Hi, I'm Dave Ackley. Let me show you something. I'd like to present the results of some work that Michael Lippman and I have done at Belcor in the last several months. First, I'd like to motivate the problem a little bit, and then present the combined evolutionary learning algorithm that we developed, show how it works, and then present some anecdotal observations of phenomena that we observed in particular runs. So let's start at the top. There's lots of ways to go about learning. Supervised learning is the most popular, where an error vector telling each output bit what it should have done is provided. Associative reinforcement learning is weaker, providing only a success or failure signal rather than detailed error information. And temporal reinforcement learning is more difficult still, because the reinforcement signal may be delayed with respect to the actions that caused it. Now, each of these learning paradigms in turn is weaker than the last in the sense that the teacher or the environment provides less feedback to the learner. We got to wondering, if you took that as far as you could, what sort of situation would you end up with? Well, certainly feedback would be very rare, and in the limit there'd be just one bit of feedback, and it would come at the very end. And that led us to think of natural selection as the most difficult teacher. It's worse than temporal reinforcement learning because the nature of the feedback, that is to say, the death of the organism, makes it very difficult to perform any learning after the information arrives. So the question we ended up facing was, how can an organism learn during its lifetime given only its own death as feedback? And the approach we developed we call evolutionary reinforcement learning. Now, there's no external reinforcement available, but the key idea is that we can evolve an internal reinforcement signal. And the way that we did that was by genetically specifying an evaluation function that maps from states of affairs, inputs, to some number indicating how well things are going. And then changes in the evaluation from moment to moment are treated as reinforcement signals to drive the learning. So organisms with good evaluation functions in their genes will tend to learn good things and will proliferate, and organisms with stupid evaluation functions will learn stupid things and probably die childless. All of this hinges on having a reinforcement learning algorithm underneath this, capable of exploiting the signals coming from the evaluation function. In the course of this work, we developed a new reinforcement learning algorithm we called CRBP, which stands for complementary reinforcement backpropagation. The idea is very simple. If you take a backpropagation network, that'll take an input and provide you with a continuous output vector. And the basic idea is to treat the continuous outputs as probabilities for producing a randomized binary output vector. So in this case, we got, say, 0, 1, with a lower probability here and a higher probability there. We then take the binary vector and pass it off to the reinforcement function, and if the reinforcement is positive, then we take the binary output vector and treat it as the target for learning for backpropagation. If the reinforcement's negative, we complement the output vector and treat that as the target for learning. So ERL uses CRBP for the reinforcement learning and the genetically specified evaluation network for a source of reinforcement signals. So these weights don't change. They're fixed genetically and remain constant for the life of the organism. As each new input comes, it flows through these weights to produce an evaluation, which is just some real number now, which is then compared to the previous evaluation. In this case, it's lower, so the reinforcement signal is negative, and CRBP would then specify complementing the output vector and so forth. So the overall algorithm has two parts. As far as evolution goes, it's very simple. When it's time to give birth, create a new organism because of the success of one that you've already got, you copy the parent's genes, the genetic information. If there's another agent, organism sufficiently nearby, you perform a crossover operation with their genes. If not, you just pass them through. And then with some low probability, you flip a few bits, and then you use the genetic information to build the networks. In the case of the evaluation network, to fix the weights of the network, and in the case of the behavior network, trained by backpropagation, to set their initial values. And then day by day, during learning, the loop is very simply get the new input, produce an evaluation and compare it to the previous to get a reinforcement signal, perform reinforcement learning based on that signal, use the updated network to generate a new action randomly, perform the action, and loop. So that's basically the approach. And how does it work? Actually, it's not easy to find algorithms to compare ERL with, because most assume more freedom than we've allowed ourselves here. For example, in a traditional genetic algorithm, the population size is taken to be a free variable, anything that you wish. Whereas in this context, survival is very much an individual matter, and the population size is something that you observe in the results. We compared ERL with four other algorithms. First, an algorithm that directly evolved a behavioral network without any learning. One that learned in the behavioral network using a non-evolving fixed random evaluation function. Non-learning and non-evolving random behavior functions. And finally, agents that moved completely at random. We ran each algorithm 100 times and measured how long it took the populations to become extinct or to reach 1 million time steps at which time they were stopped. Here's the data we obtained. On the x-axis is the extinction time, and on the y-axis is the percent of populations that were extinct by the corresponding time. The primary effect is that there's a separation between E and F and the other three algorithms. It's interesting to note that E and F are the only algorithms that involve no variability in the behavior patterns during the life of the individual. In both cases, their behavior is controlled by a map which is fixed for the lifetime of the individual. By contrast, the other three algorithms all involve some degree of variability. In the case of the Brownian agents, their behavior is completely random, and that actually appears to be the most effective strategy in the early periods. The learning-only algorithm does quite well in the range up to 80,000 or so, and it's only at time lengths greater than 100,000 steps that the combined evolutionary reinforcement learning algorithm begins to pull away and has produced 7 stable populations that were successful to reach the 1 million time step limit. Well, that's how they work. And that basically sums up the talk. And now we can start the demo. I have 5 little stories I'd like to tell you, all of them relating to one particular run whose random number seed is shown there, that happened to reach the 1 million step limit. This is an overview of the world. It's a 100 by 100 array framed by impassable walls or mountains, also some scattered through the center as you see. And within the walls there are open spaces, there are trees that you may be able to see, small spots representing food plants, and agents and carnivores. This diagram depicts the array of inputs that each agent receives. The upper box is arranged by row representing the directions of the compass, south, east, west, and north, which are the 4 directions that an agent can see, and each column represents a particular object which may be visible in that direction. So this is proportional to how much energy the agent currently possesses. This unit corresponds to its current health or damage status. Here is an evaluation function possessed by an agent. In this case, the red squares correspond to an input that's negatively valued in the evaluation, green corresponds to a positive evaluation, and white corresponds to a 0 valuation. This particular agent possessing this DNA is going to have trouble because the value of its own health is negative. And here is that agent, moving in the world, mostly moving south, managing to eat some food, before he discovers hitting his head against the wall. And thus, scratch one evaluation function. This agent has a similar defect and manages to locate a bit of wall out in the middle of no place. This agent is attracted to walls to the north, causing its attention to be diverted at an inopportune time. Of the 16 agents originally seeded in the world, 14 were dead before 2,000 steps had passed. This fellow isn't in too bad shape. He's negatively disposed towards mountains, which is a good idea. Positively disposed towards having energy, which is also a good idea. Doesn't seem to care about health, and there are certain defects here and there. Defect that is apparent is a carnivore to the south leads to a recommendation of moving south, which is not entirely healthy. Here he is living in the world. He's a fairly effective eater. At about 600 time steps, he was quite lucky to survive an extended encounter with a carnivore that nearly cost his life. However, the result of the learning algorithm in this interaction was such that it corrected the genetic defect in the action network he was born with. And shortly thereafter, he produced the first of his four children. This agent would live about 5,500 time steps, but all of the 272 generations that followed before a million time steps would reach were his descendants. As the thousands of time steps pass by, the agent population begins to grow. And with such success come new problems. The world's not as roomy as it used to be. There's more crowding, there's more competition. If we back up again and take a lower resolution view in time, the predator-prey oscillations become more apparent. Like their common ancestor, the agents alive in this time period have a bias towards the south and the west due to the loading in the original action networks. When it gets crowded down there against the wall, the agents start running into each other. They're killing and eating each other down there, offspring eating parent, and they're learning to like it. Well, the cannibalism cult never amounted to anything very much in the long run. And if you step back and look at it from the long view, you can't even see a sign of it. So here's the entire run. Top to bottom, agents, carnivores, plants, and trees. At this scale, the effects of learning, the predator-prey cycles are all pretty much squeezed out, and you can see the effects of evolution. Somewhere between 300,000 and 500,000, the agent population began to develop a solution to the carnivore problem, and by 500,000 or 600,000, the problem was essentially solved. You can see that the final evaluation function produced at the end of the 1 million step run is considerably improved over Adam's evaluation. Most particularly, the carnivore negative values have been strengthened and the health has been picked up as a valuable asset. This is far from a perfect DNA, one would think. We would expect food to be valued in all directions and walls to be avoided. So we went back and handcrafted a genetic code that corresponded to the best action network we could think of. If there's food in any direction, approach. If there's a carnivore, sidestep, avoid the walls, and otherwise move completely randomly without any bias towards a corner. We set it up as an algorithm F with no evolution, no learning, started it off in the world. And it did very well. But the funny thing was that it ended up at a population size much smaller than the best of these naturally evolved guys, like the ones I've shown. It would have population sizes between 10 and 30, maybe even dipping down into the single digits from time to time. Whereas these guys were between 30 and 60 by and large at the time, by the time they reached the end of the line. We went back and looked to see what was going on, and basically our hand design guys were just a plague on the land. They were eating everything. They were eating all the food as soon as it was born, before it had a chance to reach its full food value, and then having famines and starving. And if you think about success in terms of the most days of life for the most people, then the naturally evolved guys, with their little imperfections that cause them to miss things from here and there, it's a much better solution than the obviously perfect individual. Of course, if you took a stable population of natural guys like this and stuck in a couple of those hand-designed guys, they'd take over in a couple of generations, wipe these guys out. I guess that's life.
It was a fun project and taught us a little bit about learning and how connected to this.
Uh-huh.
All right, thanks. See you next week, last week of class.
It's a long video.
What day is the exam?
The 20th?
January 20th?
Yeah.
Is it here?